Hey, man, how's it going, y'all? Oh, yeah? All right, well, sometimes I like pretending I can hear you answer me. I don't know. This probably sounds pretty stupid. Whatever. Anyway, I'm Scott Horton. It's my radio show. I'm not much of a radio host as far as, you know, broadcasting, professionalism, and all that crap, but who wants to hear that, right? It's just me versus the wars, and then I get by with a little help from the best journalists in the world. I just ask them what's true, and they make my case for non-interventionism for me, basically. Yeah. I am an anti-government extremist of the very worst type, and hope to influence you along those lines as well. So that's basically the show. Hey, guess what? Today is Bill of Rights Day. Or at least, I saw a tweet that said that, and I didn't bother Googling it to make sure. So let's talk about the Bill of Rights for a minute. Oh, wait. Peter Van Buren is going to be here to talk about the Iraq War. And Phil Giraldi is going to be here to talk about Turkey and the presidency of Mr. Erdogan over there. And then Scott Adams is going to be on the show. Yeah, Scott Adams, the cartoonist that does the Dilbert cartoons. He's been saying things that to me are very interesting about this master wizard persuader, Donald Trump. And very interesting analysis, and I thought, you know, I want to hear some more of it, and maybe you do too, so that should be cool. Adams is on the show today. Boulder in the chat room is asking. He is on the show. So that's going to be cool, man. All right, now let's talk about the Bill of Rights. By the time I get to number 5, I'm probably going to have to Google it up here so I make sure not to miss any parts of it. But I think I can do, you know, 1 through 4 off the top of my head anyway. So here's the thing. Before the actual Bill of Rights, you know what the Bill of Rights is, right? So they passed this Constitution, 1791, it came into effect, but they had promised that the first order of business of the new government would be to pass a Bill of Rights and add it to the Constitution, so that's the first thing that they did. And James Madison, the principal author of the Constitution, became the first Speaker of the House of Representatives, or maybe the second or something, I don't know, after a minute, but whatever it was. And I think the first one. And they wrote up the Bill of Rights. And originally there were 12 proposed amendments, and they whittled it down to 10. And, in fact, one of the original 12 that wasn't passed back then was finally passed as the 27th Amendment in the 1990s, and it was forbidding Congress from voting themselves pay raises. You can see why that was voted down the first time. You know, they would have to stand for election before they could get the raise. That was the thing. Anyway, here's the thing about the Bill of Rights. For some reason, probably no reason, I don't know, I used to think it was a big plot, but I guess probably not. I don't know, maybe it is. They hardly ever include the preamble to the Bill of Rights. Now, we all know about the preamble to the Constitution. We, the people, say the government can do whatever it wants in order to make us all happy, right? And that what it says, something like that. And that's all the Constitution you need to know, really, if you ask your junior high school teachers. We the people say, yeah, go ahead. That's the Constitution. Well, so what the Bill of and we all know that. But there's a preamble to the Bill of Rights as well. And the preamble to the Bill of Rights, and again, I don't have it in front of me. I should have Googled it. But anyway, off the top of my head, it's something very close to conventions of a number of the states having expressed at their time of adopting the Constitution a concern wishing to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers by the national government, that new declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added in order to guarantee confidence in the new government. That's what it says. Okay, so in essence, it's saying, this is not, they're referencing the history there that I told you, right? That people had insisted, okay, if we're going to pass this Constitution, we want a Bill of Rights kind of thing. And so that was their first order of business. So they referenced that history. That's why we're doing this. Because you guys said, and we promised. But then what was it? What was the convention's wishes that they wanted to respect here? That declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added. Now, they weren't talking about your rights being restricted. They were talking about, they were, you know, in principle, supposedly, free men who were already free, who were creating a state, and they were adding new conditions. We will allow you to exist, but you must stay behind these lines. It does not say, I hope I'm making myself clear and don't sound too just stupid and pedantic about it, whatever. But point is, it doesn't say, here are some freedoms that the government has decided that you are good enough for now until we change our mind. But here, little pet, we will allow you to speak freely as long as we like it. We'll allow you to have a gun as long as you promise only to shoot ducks with it. Okay? It doesn't say that. The entire premise of the Bill of Rights is that free human beings are adding restrictive clauses. It shouldn't even be called the Bill of Rights. Alexander Hamilton's argument at the time against passing it was that, and I think quite cynically and dishonestly, actually, because we all know what position he took as soon as the government came into being. He said anything not explicitly forbidden by the Constitution is therefore allowed. Let's do it. Including creating a central bank and going to war and whatever he wanted. Well, that was in there. But anyway, at the time he argued that, wait a minute, a Bill of Rights is something that a divine king grants to his subjects. But in our system of government, we all have the divine right equally. We are free, all of us. And we are telling the government what its powers are, which is the exact opposite scheme of things. So if you pass a Bill of Rights, you'll be confusing the issue. Of course Congress can't pass a law to take away your freedom of speech or to take away your guns, because there's nothing in the Constitution that delegates that power to them in the first place. You would have to tell them they could before you have to tell them they can't, cried Alexander Hamilton. In fact, he just wanted no restrictions on the power of government at all. He wanted to call Washington your majesty, and did. But so that's the thing about the Bill of Rights, is it's not supposed to be a Bill of Rights. It's a bill of restrictions created by free people against the state that they had just mistakenly granted the power to exist. And so anyway, that's why the language of the Constitution says things like Congress shall pass no law, the people's rights shall not be violated, the people's rights shall not be infringed. And that's why the Ninth Amendment says, hey, pal, just because there's a certain list of rights delegated here is in no way meant to imply that these are all of the rights retained by the people. Rights are things retained by people. This is not a definitive list. This is a society of people who believe in natural rights. That self-evidently, don't even have to prove it. I have a musket and I will shoot you. I mean it. It is self-evident proof that everybody has the exact same divine right as the king does, so he can suck it. That's the premise of the whole thing. We're going to overthrow a king, we're going to create a limited republic, and its powers will be defined by the law. And just because we have a certain list of restrictions against them should never be taken to imply that this is all of our rights. And then the 10th Amendment again reiterates the pretended theory anyway, that any powers that are not expressly delegated to the U.S., to the national government, by the Constitution, are reserved to the states or the people. Now, neither the 9th or 10th Amendments have ever really been held up. The 10th Amendment has been held up in the case of local sheriffs being forced to do gun checks, a couple of other things. I guess gun-free zones near schools. There was a 10th Amendment ruling against that. That's good. And there have been very few other, you know, important cases really upholding the 10th Amendment. And I don't think the 9th Amendment has ever been invoked. Even in Roe versus Wade, I don't think they invoked the 9th Amendment, where they sure could have. Why not? I don't know. But I don't think the courts have ever upheld the 9th Amendment as meaning a thing, which is pretty telling. But anyway, I'll be back with more about the Bill of Rights right after this.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I got three good interviews coming up. Man, I really wanted to have a Yemen guest on today. Tomorrow. I got to get somebody from the Pew Survey people on, too, to talk about the Islams. Anyway, I'm talking about the Bill of Rights here. And before I get to the substance of the things, and I'll have to try to go fast through the 10 here, but I want to reference Carol Quigley, the author of The Evolution of Civilizations, The Anglo-American Establishment, and Tragedy and Hope. Many of you may be quite familiar. But the thing that I wanted to mention that he talks about in there, and maybe I could be conflating Quigley with some other things I read too, but no, I think this is mostly that, what I read from Quigley. And I haven't read The Evolution of Civilizations, but I downloaded it and plan to read it one day. But I read Tragedy and Hope back years ago. And right in the beginning, I don't know if it's the introduction or chapter one or chapter two or something like that, Quigley goes into this whole, you know, in-depth theory of how freedom is almost entirely dependent upon the distribution of weapons technology. And that back when everybody in Europe fought on foot with swords, that basically things were, you know, power was devolved enough that people had more or less freedom. But then as soon as the saddle was invented and warfare became much more specialized and the few who could fight on horseback had such an advantage over everyone else, then all of a sudden the kings consolidated so much more power with their knights there available to keep everybody else down and that kind of thing. And then right at the time, coincidentally, around the time that the New World is being settled because of the advances in ship technology, yeah, the invention of the musket. And the ability to shoot a man off a horseback from far away, a lot longer than sword range. And so now all of a sudden, blam, power devolves again. Not much about ideology. There might be a lesson in here for liberals, maybe a few lessons for liberals, conservatives, and everybody else, but you might see where I'm kind of sort of going with this. The American experiment, as they call it, began at a time when, obviously, relevant disclaimers kick in, property-owning white men, but that was devolved enough, all were as well-armed as each other. And a regiment of the U.S. Army wasn't much more powerful. Maybe they had a bit more cannon or whatever like that, but they weren't much more powerful than any group of Minutemen in any town. And it was in that atmosphere that this old law was written. That says, hey, government, here are the things that you can't do to us. Hey, government, here's our line in the sand. And we mean it. And you're terrified. And you better be. I'm not saying there's anything perfect about the whole situation or anything like that. I'm not playing down slavery or oppression of Indians or women or anything else. I'm just saying, for this part of the story, power was devolved enough, and the law that we still sort of, kind of, pseudo, maybe ostensibly have a little bit of left, was written in that situation of devolved power. Now, of course, our government has all the specialized weaponry in the whole wide world. And never even mind calling out the army. Our local sheriff's departments are militarized enough to make abject slaves out of this entire society. Oh, except for Amendment Number 2, which we'll get to in a sec. But they have, come on, let's get real. They've got, comes down to it, nukes. They got tanks. You think it's a coincidence that the biggest military base in America is 100 miles up the road from Austin, Texas? Fort Hood is there so that the politicians in this town will never even think for a moment about breaking away. They don't have a choice. That war was already fought and lost. And Fort Hood should be called Fort Your Ass Has Been Conquered, and don't forget it. It's amazing how people are like, oh yeah, I'm real patriotic about Fort Hood and da-da-da, and don't realize why it's there. It's the size of Austin, 100 miles north of Austin. 90. Anyway, point being, when this old law is gone, we will live in abject totalitarian slavery. This is all we got is a few judges, I don't know, a dozen maybe in our whole society, who still believe in some kooky ideological way in the law and the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights in some fashion. Without that, we've got nothing. Without that, all government has complete and total immunity to do anything. Therefore, none of the laws that describe what they are to do have meaning at all. They are lawless. They're completely outside the law. And we're skating right on the edge of that. As you can see, especially, you know, when you look, and obviously I'm not going to have time now with all my ranting and raving. As you go back and look at especially Amendments 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, your process, what the government may or may not do to you. Of course, there are calls right now. The front runner by far is calling for outright violations of the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. There are plenty of restrictions on speech in various ways and on the press, although most of that is de facto. The right of the people peaceably to assemble, of course, is violated daily in America. And the right to petition the government, that means your right to sue them. That doesn't mean your right to sign your name to a stupid little piece of paper begging, please, master. That means your right to sue them. That means they don't have sovereign immunity from the law. That's what that means. And yet, that's been null and void for so long that people don't even know that that's what it means. You know? It's amazing. Anyway, there's a reason that Amendment 2 says the people can stay as armed as the state. I guess they didn't imagine Apache helicopters and whatever, but at least AR-15s clearly are the modern-day musket, that equivalent. And look, especially for you liberals who just abhor guns and you're afraid of people that you don't know or control having them and what they might do with them or whatever like that, just imagine what this society would be like if the people had already all been disarmed. You know, like if FDR had accomplished it back in the 30s when he first started trying. Just think what abject slaves we would be right now with the government having no reason to fear what might happen were they to go neighborhood to neighborhood, administering whatever punishments or, you know, whatever arrests, you know, sweeps, this, that, whatever. They know that there are lines that they cannot cross without getting shot when it comes to mass persecution of this society. And that's why Amendment 2 is there. You can ask Thomas Jefferson. He wrote all about it. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. That's my real point. Don't you see?
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Well, better get the backup recorder going for just in cases. All right, cool deal. On with the interviews. First up is Peter Van Buren. This time, again, writing for Tom Dispatch and republished at antiwar.com. Who will fight the Islamic State? Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Scott. How are you today?
I'm doing real good, and appreciate you joining us. I should have mentioned that you worked for the State Department for how long again?
Oh, my goodness. It was 24 long years.
24 long years, and including in Iraq in the later years of Iraq War II, correct?
Absolutely. I was there from 2009 to 2010, embedded with U.S. military, reconstructing Iraq on behalf of the taxpayers. We didn't do so well, and I just like to throw out an apology to everyone for personally screwing up things in Iraq.
Yeah, but what about the surge worked? I heard that the surge worked. And it sounded really convincing because I heard it over and over and over again.
The surge is part of the mythology that's grown up around the Iraq war, and it serves a couple of handy purposes in claiming that it worked. And I'll be happy to circle back and explain why it didn't work, but I think it's very important to understand why this myth has been promoted around the war by the government. The first, of course, is the generic sense that, you know, we actually didn't really lose. Yeah, there were some bumps in the road, but overall we also had some victories in there. That's always a nice meme to throw out when you did get your butt kicked. The other, I think, is to make it seem like anything really bad that happened after we left was the Iraqis' fault. Because with the myth of the surge comes the addendum myth, if you will, that everything was in pretty good shape when the United States pulled out in 2011, and it was Iraqi infighting that suddenly popped up, you know, the day we pulled out the last soldier that messed up all our good work. The third reason that we promote the myth of the surge's success is because it sets up the current round in the Middle East, where we are now, the United States government now is claiming that our strategy is largely dependent on the Sunni tribes of Iraq and some others to join the equivalent of a new surge, and just like the old surge, supposedly help us defeat ISIS. That kind of sets up three very dangerous reasons, some forward-looking, that will suggest that the myth of the surge will continue to batter away at whatever we're trying to do in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, so I want to get to all the kind of surrounding states and all that like you do in this great article. It's a really great article, everybody. I beg you to read it, seriously. Who will fight the Islamic State? It'll really help inform you there. But as far as that, the new surge, the new awakening, does that have to be part and parcel of a policy that insists that Iraq will continue to exist and that the Baghdad government, so-called democratic government, will be the government of it all, and that all that needs to happen is if we can just arm up and ally with and train up and finance the moderate tribal leaders of former Iraqi Sunnistan and then forge those compromises, achieve those benchmarks that weren't achieved back in 2007, achieve them now, that then that is the path to marginalizing and ultimately defeating the Islamic State? Or is it, which obviously is stupid, I mean to imply, or is it possible that maybe they can do some kind of awakening and, like John Bolton said in the New York Times, we'll just create a new Sunni stand, but it won't be these bastards, it'll be, you know, some tribal chief?
I'm going to soon agree with John Bolton on something, and I hope lightning doesn't hit me before I say that, but Let me back up to your first point, and that is whether or not this attempt to get the Sunnis involved in fighting ISIS is part of an attempt to recreate or maintain this idea that there is an entity that we know as Iraq that looks something like the Iraq of, you know, 20 years ago. You know, if you had asked me that question, whatever, 6-8 months ago, I would have said, yep, that's part of the plan here, is to put the put Iraq back together into this kind of conglomeration of Sunni, Shia, and Kurds the way it used to be. Now, I have my doubts that that's really on the American wish list for this Christmas. I think, and this is more conjecture, I think, than anything that can be nailed down, because, again, Obama doesn't return my calls when I ask these questions. But I think at this point, the American policy is so desperate that they're just grasping at anything that they think might help without even going past that. So who's around the Middle East that might help fight ISIS? I don't know. How about the Sunnis? Okay, let's see if we can get them on our side. And I think really at this point it's become as simple as that, without any hopes of anything larger happening. Mm-hmm. As far as agreeing with John Bolton, again, I'm hoping to survive the lightning strike that's going to hit me. Bolton, as you mentioned, wrote an article in the New York Times saying that basically the game is over in Iraq. The only thing the United States can do is create a Sunni stan, if you will, a separate statelet that the Sunnis can live in, separate from the Shia central government in Iraq. That is what's happening anyway. I don't think that's something the United States can ever stop from happening. I think if the United States wants to pour men, women, material, weapons, money into the area, we could probably forestall it, perhaps for a very long time. But at the end of the day, since it's probably what's going to happen eventually, the argument would be, why not manage that process? Why not facilitate it in a way that kind of brings the crisis down to more manageable levels? If you recall, Scott, you and I had our first disagreement in our long and otherwise warm relationship here on this show a couple of months ago, when I actually proposed using the American military to create, what do you call, demilitarized zones, if you will, between the Shias and the Sunnis and the Kurds, and let this process evolve naturally. And since that would have included something of additional troops into Iraq, you and I think, disagreed on that one. But so there's this weird marriage of, what is that, politics makes strange bedfellows. Here I am grasping bits and pieces of the wisdom of John Bolton. That's how sad and desperate this has all gotten.
Yeah, and which everybody should go read that just for the yucks, where he talks about all of what's happened and refuses to acknowledge in any way how it came to be this way and what his role in any of this might have been or any of that. It's really fun to read in that way, you know?
He probably had that in there and the editors just cut it.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, you're probably right.
I'll just add something just for humor's sake, because you mentioned the yucks. I actually met Bolton once about a year ago or so by accident, and we had a little chat, and he presented himself as a very pleasant, very educated. We talked about Iraq, and he seemed so much more knowledgeable than the character he seems to play in public, and in a way that made me hate him even more. You know, if he was just, you know, an ignorant blowhard, through and through, then fine, he's just an ignorant blowhard, and what can you expect of them? But the fact that he was able to discuss Iraq on a very rational, very detailed, very high level, that he knows what's really going on, and he's still saying a lot of the idiotic crap that he puts out, that makes it somehow even worse. You can't forgive someone like that.
Mm-hmm. All right, now we're about to have to go to this break, but so I'm going to ask you the question before, because we got a lot of allies to discuss and everything in the next segment as well. But I wonder, if Al-Qaeda in Iraq was always the smallest part of the Sunni insurgency back then, they were the third wheel between the Ba'athists and the Sunni tribes during Iraq War II. And now they have allied with the Ba'athists and mostly, you know, dominating the tribes now. Could it be switched the other way, or is the Islamic State so much more powerful than Al-Qaeda in Iraq was then that it's not so much dependent on their alliance with the Ba'athists and that kind of thing? The three spokes on the Iraqi Sunni stand wheel we're going to talk about with Peter Van Buren on the other side of this break.
Hey, y'all, guess what?
You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours, max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Talking with Peter Van Buren, who will fight the Islamic State. And we're going to go around the board here in a second for all the foreign powers in the neighborhood and what America wants and how all that ain't working. Please read this article. It's at Tom Dispatch and antiwar.com. Who will fight the Islamic State? But at the break, so I was asking about the Sunnis of what used to be Iraqi Sunnistan there, basically Eastern Islamic State now. And so whether the three, as I've identified them anyway, the three major pillars of power in Iraqi Sunnistan, the former Ba'athists, the Islamists, and the tribal chiefs, whether maybe the Ba'athists and the tribal chiefs could flip the script on the Islamic State and take their power away, or whether the Islamic State is too far advanced in how much power they've got now for that to happen.
You know, it's an interesting question, because the internal dynamics of these organizations are largely unknown to us. But if you work with the basic idea that groups, perhaps excluding the U.S. government, act in their own self-interest, and that self-interest is basically built around power, control, and economics, it's hard to see why the Sunnis, the indigenous Sunnis, would really back away from ISIS. First of all, we have come to understand that ISIS is sharing oil revenues with the Sunni tribes, and paying people to be your friend is, in fact, a legitimate strategy, as long as you've got the money flowing. From the Sunni side, ISIS is the army, the protectors that they need against the Shia militias, who definitely seek to drive them out of Iraq, if not actually just destroy them and kill them. So it is a very symbiotic relationship that benefits both sides, and it's difficult to imagine why or how you could break that bond at this point in time. In fact, if anything, America's policy now of so aggressively supporting the Shia militias in the so-called fight against ISIS, of course they're killing plenty of indigenous Sunnis along the way, if anything, forces the indigenous Sunnis to look for that protection from ISIS, simply for their own survival. Parenthetically, it's important to understand that the reason the United States feels it's forced to support the Shia militias is because the Iraqi army we spent billions of dollars creating and training turned out to be largely smoke and mirrors. They ran away first shots with ISIS, and they turned out to be fewer soldiers and less equipment than we ever expected them to have, because basically they were padding their budgets with American dollars. So you can't separate the causes of these things from the outcomes, and you can't separate all that from what is very likely to happen in the future. Short answer, no one is going to fight America's war for them. They're going to fight bits and pieces of America's war when it benefits them, and they're going to stop when they're done being benefited. Mm-hmm. If anything, those of us who have vague memories of our high school math classes, if we remember Venn diagrams, these are when circles kind of overlap in part. And that overlapping area gets kind of shaded in, and the outside stuff stays blank. And that's largely what you're seeing now in the Middle East, where killing ISIS benefits Turkey and the United States. There's that little overlap. But when killing Kurds only helps the Turks, and the Americans are seeing their own allies getting shot by the Turks, well, then that's kind of outside the shaded area, if you will.
Right, gotcha. All right, well, still, you have 6 minutes, so could you go around pick clockwise or counterclockwise or however you want to do it? Because America's allied with, we're at least de facto allied with the Iranians and the Shiite militias in Iraq, as you just described, and we're officially allies with everybody else, the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Egyptians, the Turks, and, oh, I guess you could count out Assad, but at least we're some of the time de facto allied with him a little, maybe, yeah, or someday could be or something. I don't know. So what's so difficult about the damn war? If everybody over there has an American sock, what the hell is the point of being an empire if our satellites won't go invade somebody for us? Peter, well, I don't get it.
I think you're not getting it. Is you're right in tune with the White House. They don't seem to get it either. The idea again is that all these different entities, the Turks, the Kurds, the Sunnis, the Shias, the Iranians, the Russians, everybody in Syria. I can't even begin to delineate the different groups. They all have their own agendas. And they're not America's allies, and they're not our friends, and they're not our satellites. They're simply these very awkward, very not forward-looking marriages of convenience, if you will. The Kurds want their own nation. And the nation that they want is primarily in what's still called Iraq. Part of it is in Syria, and part of it is in Turkey. If they can, well, first of all, they need to kill all the ISIS people in those areas so that they can own it. And if they can persuade the Americans to arm them and be the Kurdistani Air Force in pursuit of their goals, because the Americans are saying, well, somebody's got to kill ISIS and, the secondary and tertiary results be damned. Well, the Kurds are happy to go along with that. They're getting weapons and support that otherwise they would never get. And as long as America chooses to pretend it's not more about Kurdish independence than it is about ISIS, well, America goes along with it. And you can say the same thing about the Turks. The United States cut a deal with the devil. We wanted the air bases to use in Turkey to fly aircraft into Syria, particularly drones, which have a shorter range. So we wanted those air bases. And in return for that, we've agreed to turn a blind eye to the Kurds fighting the Turks fighting the Kurds. We've also turned a blind eye to the fact that the Turks and the Iraqis are starting to get a little bit of a tussle there. And we've certainly turned a blind eye to the fact that the Turks have allowed ISIS to transit, new recruits to transit their country into Syria, never mind allowing ISIS oil to transit out of the area. So, we traded an awful lot away for very little, and we still kind of think that was a good deal. With the Russians, everyone talks about Putin being a mastermind or something. I don't agree. I think he's the luckiest damn guy in the world. He would have always wanted a bigger military presence in the Middle East. He wanted to support Assad. He has no great love for Muslim extremists, given the way things work inside of Russia. And so he uses America's desire for someone to go fight ISIS as carte blanche to move back into the area and achieve all of his goals. At the end of the day, this whole thing is just going to fall apart. It is falling apart. We're watching it happen in real time. And America will once again come to the inevitable conclusion that the world doesn't work the way we want it to work. It's not a chessboard. And we are outplayed every time by our own short-sightedness.
Yeah. Well, part of the theory of how they, blundered into the Syria war with Obama saying, oh, Assad must go and all this. It was supposed to be so easy. I think back to interviewing all different people, not just the very best of the best, like Patrick Coburn, who, obviously has perspective, bar none kind of thing. But, it seemed apparent to a lot of people that, if Libya was more or less easy as a just simple kind of east to west battle and backed with full, you know, UN authorized air power, pseudo authorized air power. Obviously they twisted the resolution, but still. And that was, you know, it was cut and dry enough that even though it took 9 months, it was still a foregone conclusion that eventually they're going to get Gaddafi and they'll be done destroying his state and whatever. But at the same time, it was obvious that it's not going to be like that in Syria. That in fact, maybe even a majority of Sunnis support the Ba'athist government, as at least compared to a bunch of head chopping bin Ladenites. And it's a much bigger, much more complicated place, and you have a lot more ethnic and religious minorities with a much bigger stake in the government, and you're sure as hell not going to get the Russians to give a UN resolution supporting a no-fly zone again or any of that. So it was obvious it wasn't going to be some cut-and-dry thing. Yep. And speaking to Coburn, Coburn was saying, Jesus, this is going to be like Lebanon for 15 years from 75 to 90 kind of thing. This is just an absolute nightmare. People like him were saying stuff like that, but even the dummies knew better than this will be simple cut and dry like Libya. And yet still they did it anyway. And so I guess what I'm asking is really the State Department and the Pentagon and the conversations on the couches in the Oval Office were really that much dumber than the ones going on this show.
You know, this is a question that bothers me all the time.
Oh, and I got to let you go, I know. So, yeah, last question, sorry.
You and I are not necessarily the smartest guy in the room. And yet the things we're talking about here are so simple and obvious that the only conclusion is you're left with two conclusions. One is that these people are somehow mentally disabled and have been elected and appointed to these high positions, and we really can't blame them. It's not their fault. It's, you know, their moms smoke and drank when they were pregnant. Or they are sort of as I described John Bolton earlier. They are smart people. They're knowledgeable people. They know what's going on. But in public, they play a role of folks who don't know what's going on. You're left then, and this is another show, to ask the question of why do they do that? And that gets into those dark, hairy questions about military-industrial complex and shadow governments and secondary motives that are hidden behind other motives. I'm going to go with that latter one. I don't think these are stupid people, and I don't think you and I and people like Cockburn are the only folks who have somehow stumbled into this. Nope. I think there's a lot of bad things going on out there.
Yep. All right. Well, listen, man, thanks a lot for coming back on the show. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. I'll see you again in the new year, Scott.
Yeah, you will. All right, y'all. Yeah, Merry Christmas to you and all that. Peter Van Buren, everybody. He is writing for Tom Dispatch. He has his own blog, Tom Joe something. I don't have it in front of me. Wait, yeah, I do. No, I don't. But anyway, Peter Van Buren, TomDispatch.com and Antiwar.com, who will fight the Islamic State?
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back. Hey, there's an hour and a half long BBC interview of Shaker Ahmer on the antiwar.com blog right now that I'm going to watch later this afternoon. I want to make sure I mention that today. He was in Guantanamo forever and ever, whatever. He was the last Brit in Guantanamo. Anyway, on to our next guest. It's Phil Giraldi, former CIA and DIA officer, executive director of the Council for the National Interest. That's the America First lobby in Washington, D.C. And, of course, regular writer for UNS.com and the American Conservative Magazine. How's it going, Phil? Welcome back. Oh,
that's from Moscow. Did you know that?
I'm sorry. I hit the wrong dang button. Say again.
Yeah, I just got back from Moscow. I didn't know if you knew that I was making a trip.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I read that Somewhere, something. I guess maybe you had mentioned it in an article or maybe in an email. But yeah, no, I had forgotten though. So, geez, let's talk about that first. Go ahead.
Yeah, well,
it was just a vacation, or you were over there meeting with Putin, or what?
Well, actually, I did kind of meet with Putin.
Really?
We were there at a conference sponsored by what used to be called Russia Today. It's now RT International. It's a their television network that's mostly in English, and it's a very respectable network. Except, of course, when they're having stories about Russia or Ukraine or something like that, there is definitely a bit of spin. But apart from that, they have very good reporters, and we. A bunch of us from the States were over there for a conference as speakers. So it was kind of interesting. And while I was there to connect with what we're going to be talking about today, everybody wanted to know about Turkey. That's all I talked about.
Right. And so your speech then was something along the lines of this article today at UNS.com?
A lot of it was. I had my initial speech was basically the question in front of our panel. Ray McGovern was on the panel. I think you know him. The question before our panel was, can you protect privacy, when it's being attacked by people who are pushing for national security and intrusion into communications and stuff like that? And I basically argued, yeah, you could, but you would have to force the government to step back considerably from where it's at and reinstate a lot of the procedures that we used to have before the government could come and tap your phone. And of course, that's not going to happen.
Right. All right. So now on the, as far as meeting Putin, how'd that go? Was he there?
Well, they had a gala dinner and he appeared. And so I met him as much as anybody else met him, just kind of standing around gawking.
Yeah, sure.
Shevardnadze was there, Edward Shevardnadze. Gorbachev was there. There were a whole lot of people that it was kind of surprising to see them. It was quite an experience.
Oh yeah, well I accuse you of being a communist and a traitor. How do you answer that?
That's okay.
Oh, you don't mind?
No, I don't mind anymore. I've been called worse.
All right, well, so, but now you weren't there because you've turned on America. Why were you there?
Well, I was there basically because it was an offer, a paid offer to go over and see Russia. I've never been to Russia. Moscow was a delightful city. Any kind of recollection on the part of the American huddled masses that it was kind of a gray socialist place is completely wrong. There was, you'll probably find this one hard to believe, but there was a Christmas market in Red Square right across from Lenin's tomb. And nobody was going into Lenin's tomb, and there were a lot of people going into the Christmas market. And, it's kind of there were a lot of eye-opening experiences just kind of being there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Oh, it was George Kennan in the interview in 1998 with Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, who says, "Hey, listen, these aren't the communists' enemies. These are the guys who overthrew them for us." We ought to love these guys. Dude, they're the ones who destroyed communism, and yet we act like, oh, no, the Russians still. And snap out of it, you dummies.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the interesting things, of course, was that all Russians now for some time have been learning English as part of the standard curriculum starting in first grade. So almost everybody spoke English. And the food was good. The hotel was nice. The people were pleasant. There was a lot to see, a lot to do. I'm even thinking of going back on a vacation.
All right. Well, so what about the danger? We'll get back to Turkey, and Turkey's obviously part of it. What about the danger of a real Cold War again with them? Because they keep saying that. But it seems like mostly PR. And obviously we have America picked a fight in Ukraine and America picked a fight in Syria. And we have the Russian response, which is called aggression. Here in America, not that I'm necessarily justifying whatever Putin does or anything like that, but I do remember what came first, the invasion of South Ossetia or the Russian invasion of it back in 08, unlike most in the media. But anyway, so how bad is it really, Phil? Some people say, hey, it hadn't been this bad since the Cuban Missile Crisis, never even mind the 80s brinksmanship.
Well, I think it depends on who you talk to, but certainly all the Russians I met, and let me say it categorically, the Russians I met were much more aware of foreign policy issues and what's going on in the world than most Americans would be. They were much more aware, and they all asked me the same thing. They said, why is it that the United States seems to hate us? And why is it that your media can never say a good thing about us? And, you know, I had trouble answering those questions. I even come out with a lot of complicated crap about neocons and this, that, and the other thing. But it's kind of true. We're creating an enemy where it's not necessary. And we have no vital interests, actually, that would compel us to create an enemy. And I kept trying to explain that to them. I was saying, you know, it's kind of U.S. politics, and everybody's wondering, what is Obama doing? And why do you keep criticizing us no matter what we do? And I said, you know, you've got a point.
Yeah, it's the planes, man. The planes and the ships, those big ticket items. You know, you can fight insurgents all day for almost free compared to the cost of a real Cold War. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, why would these clowns like John McCain? I come back and I listen to John McCain, and I was thinking, this guy should be taken out and tied up somewhere. Well, maybe we can arrange that. I don't know. But the fact is, you know, these people are out of their minds. Any thought of going back to a Cold War, which has as the bottom line nuclear obliteration for everybody, what is wrong with these people? I don't get it.
Yeah, well, it's pretty far out of control. It seems to me, Phil, maybe they even say this to the Russians out loud, but at least they think it's implied that, hey, you know, we're just bullshitting, right? We're just making money here and whatever. Like, there's some kind of tacit agreement to do brinksmanship on both sides, but maybe the Russians don't really want to play. But the Americans are like, hey, you make a great enemy for us and so tough, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, Putin is an old-style nationalist. And there were things that, you know, happened during this trip that just were eye-openers. Like, for example, on the back wall of the Kremlin, there's the Russian War Memorial to the Second World War. And there's, you know, the memorial memorializes 27 million people who were killed, Russians who were killed in the war. And one of the American professors I was with, a guy from American University, he made a comment. He says, you know, if you consider 9/11 to be one of the ultimate terrorist incidents or outrages ever, he said you would have to take a 9/11 every single day for 9 years to realize the same numbers as the Russians who were killed in the Second World War. And he said if you can't figure out that has a huge impact in how people think and how they view war and how they view all these other things, then you're not listening.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, man, is Americans just can't look out of those eyes. Americans don't take war seriously. War is a movie. War is not a real thing. And and they certainly couldn't imagine somebody coming and wiping out 20 million Americans and what life would be like after that, what our minds would be like after that, you know?
Exactly.
Too,
and then you've got to put yourself in those shoes because this is a generation that's still kind of alive, you know? And they remember 27 million of them killed in a war. And the United States, of course, was, apart from the soldiers who actually fought it, was relatively untouched.
Yeah. Yeah, Margulies said about the Crimean Peninsula that the Russians lost hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men fighting the Nazis for Crimea. And you think they're going to give it up to the Azov Battalion and the USA? You're crazy. You think the Texans love the Alamo? Ha! You know? All right, hold on 1 second. We'll be right back with Phil Giraldi right after this. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds.
and I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Phil Giralli, former CIA officer stationed in Turkey. And now remind us, Phil, again about your career. You were the station chief, not for the country, but for a major city there, right?
Yeah, the station is always in the capital, which is Ankara. And Istanbul was a base. That's where I was.
Gotcha. And by the way, did you ever publish that hilarious book about being a CIA agent in Turkey? Because that thing is so good.
Well, I know you've read it. I haven't had time, but I'm going to do it. I mean, as soon as things kind of slow up a little bit, I hope I'm going to give it a final edit and probably do a self-publish.
Okay. Well, however you get it published, you should. It's great. It's
really great. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, so you know something about Turkey, and on the show before, you've sort of kind of defended the Erdogan regime in the sense that, hey, man, it's in this case, the secularists are against democracy because they're the minority. If you have democracy, most of the population of Turkey are basically conservative, you know, would like a conservative Islamist government, not a extremist, radical, insane one necessarily, a bin Ladenite one, but an Islamist government. And so they got one, and it's been working pretty well. They got a pretty good economy and this, that, the other thing. But then it all comes to fall apart over Syria, or I'm oversimplifying, or what?
Well, I mean, see, you know, there's a lot of complications that play out here. I mean, first of all, Erdogan has a distinct advantage in that the conservative, less educated, more religious part of the population supports him for his religiosity and his simplicity. But, you know, there are about 45% of the Turks who don't fall in that category. So it's a lot closer than one thinks, and it could eventually go another way. But you know, Erdogan has basically been playing a lot of games. I mean, he's a big part of his appeal in getting getting his party reelected with a majority last month was based on the fact that he fear-mongered relentlessly about the Kurds, and in fact basically started a kind of a civil war with them again. And this was his major pitch in terms of why the voters needed the strong man, the powerful man back in power. And so anyway, he played that very, very hard. And this shooting down the plane is all part of that, because the fact is that Erdogan has no interest in opposing ISIS, none whatsoever, but he has a great interest in stomping down the Kurds. And the reason for that is that if there were ever a Kurdish state to develop in that region, it would take a big hunk out of Syria, a big hunk out of Iraq, a big hunk out of Iran, but it would take a huge hunk out of Turkey. So this has been his primary foreign policy objective for a long time, and his predecessors, let's not leave them out too, but he's a lot more ruthless, I think, in some ways than most of them were. Right. And he has been playing this card of pretending to fight ISIS while actually fighting the Kurds. He has soldiers right now in northern Iraq near Mosul, which is, of course, the Kurdish region, and the Kurdish and the Iraqi government is trying to get him to get them out of there, but he won't leave. So this is what drives him.
Mm-hmm. Man. All right. So here's the thing, though. It's his support for the jihadists against Assad that has set the Syrian Kurds free in the first place, right? They were under the domination of Damascus before.
Yeah, there are a lot of ironies in how this plays out. But you know, the way he sees it now is he says with some correctness that when Assad started to get a little bit desperate in terms of what was going on, he started to support PKK and other Kurdish groups that have undertaken terrorist acts inside Turkey. So there is a little kind of rationale to that. But essentially, if you look at everything that goes on there from the Turkish point of view and realize that it basically is from a Kurdish point of view, then you kind of understand how everything plays out.
What all their concerns are. But here's the thing, though, is I still don't understand all their concerns. You know, our previous guest, Peter Van Buren, was also saying that you know, I mean, I'm paraphrasing both of y'all wrong, but anyway, close enough that, you know, yeah, the Kurds want independence, but hey, I thought that the Turkish, well, first of all, the Iraqi Kurdish factions, the Barzani and Talibani factions, they get along with the Erdogan government. They don't seem to, you know, want to have a war or a big problem with him. He bombs the PKK in Iraqi Kurdistan from time to time, has for years, the Turkish government, but, not, you know, apparently gets along with Barzani and Talibani. And then, Ocalan, the guy who's sitting in prison there, he had a peace deal and yeah. had a, you know, basically there was a terrible civil war in the 1990s, but mm-hmm. they've had peace in Turkey between the Kurds and, you know, I guess enough autonomy under the deal that they don't feel like seceding and having a war over it anymore. So you're saying he's, you know, turning the situation into one of war just for his own gain, but then he's creating for himself a real problem of possible Kurdish secession in the future and somewhere he's going to have a real war against them, not just bomb them, but the 1990s again.
Well, I would not agree, actually, that the Kurds in Iraq get along with Erdogan.
No?
Quite well. They don't. In fact, Erdogan was aiding and assisting several terrorist groups when the Kurds were trying to retake some areas along the border between the two countries, between Syria and Turkey, and it was Erdogan who broke the truce with Öcalan and essentially started up the civil war again. He was the one that did it.
Mm-hmm.
So and then there've been some real kind of shady things going on. You might recall just before the last election in Turkey, there was a horrific bombing of a parade or a rally
mm-hmm.
In Ankara that killed over 100 people, mostly Kurds, and it was blamed on ISIS. But I will tell you that it was actually carried out by the Turkish intelligence service. So, you know, there's a lot of weird things going on. But basically, his focus is on, you know, let's keep the Kurds. All right, he probably likes the Kurds as long as they're under his foot. And but they don't have any illusions about him kind of thinking Kurds are okay. He doesn't.
Yeah. But I guess what I was trying to get at, well, and now I need to ask you a follow-up about how you know that and that kind of thing so I can quote you better later. But also, I guess all I was really trying to get at is it seems like he's creating a situation where he is almost seems like he wants to push, as you said, he's starting this up again. He wants to push all the Kurds together just so you can have a bigger, worse war against them or what?
Well, no, he wants to keep them separated. And basically he wants to use groups like ISIS as an instrument in keeping them separated. Because who has ISIS been attacking? They're attacking the Kurds.
Jesus, is this guy a Democrat? Because he doesn't seem very good at his job, Phil.
You mean Democrat in the sense of Hillary Clinton? Or,
yeah, like a member of the party. He sounds like a terrible president. I mean, look at what he's done.
You know,
it's a complete disaster.
You know, he was a pretty good prime minister, actually. I mean, he's been around for a long time. And probably the first 6 or 7 years of his tenure, he did a lot of good things, actually. He even liberalized, you know, allowing the Kurds to use their language in a limited way, which was not possible in Turkey before, and
mm-hmm.
to have some, you know, Kurdish instruction in the schools. And you know, he did a lot of that, admittedly, because he wanted to get into the European Union. And he had to do that. But nevertheless, he did a lot of good things. The economy really went up very well in Turkey. If you go to Istanbul now, and you had been there 15 years ago, you wouldn't believe the changes. And but you know, the guy has become addicted to power, and you know what that brings. I mean, you know, we've had certainly our share of presidents by about year 7 or 8 when they think they're God.
Yeah. All right. Now, so tell me how it is that you know that you would say definitively that the Turkish government did that so-called ISIS bombing there.
I have friends in high places. Let's leave it at that.
All right. Well, that's how they do it in the New York Times. They say, hey, the CIA source said, so that's pretty damn good, I guess.
Well, actually my friends are Turks who know a lot more about what's going on than CIA does.
Ah. No,
yeah.
I'll take your word for it over the guys that still work there for sure, Phil.
Okay, thank
Thanks
you.
Very much, man. Appreciate it.
Okay, Scott. All right, bye-bye.
All right, y'all. That's the great Phil Giraldi. He is at UNZ.com, U-N-Z, UNZ.com, in the American Conservative Magazine, and is Executive Director of the Council for the National Interest. We'll be right back. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Up next, it's Scott Adams, the author of the Dilbert cartoon, and also, it turns out, a very interesting political analyst, other than in cartoon form. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. So I saw you on CNN saying some very interesting things and talked about it here on the show a little bit. And then so I've been reading your blog a little bit more and learning a little bit more about what you have to say about this Donald Trump phenomenon. And thought I'd like to give people a chance to hear it. So if you could, first of all, as you explain on your blog, could you explain the moist robot hypothesis, which I think I agree with just from hearing the title? And then... and then from there, what exactly is a master wizard, if you could, sir?
Well, the moist robot hypothesis, I wrote about in my latest book, How to Fail Almost Everything and Still Win Big. But the idea is that we're essentially programmed computers. The free will is an illusion, and that if we take care of our bodies, our minds generally go to a good place. So the idea is that we can be easily influenced by a master persuader, someone who has the talent to know how to program that user interface that is human beings. And that set of skills is very well known. Science has tested it. There's lots of studies about what influences people. I'm a trained hypnotist by background, so I recognize in Donald Trump a number of these skills of persuasion that he himself says he has. I mean, he wrote a book called The Art of the Deal, and he talks about negotiating. And that field of negotiating, hypnosis, persuasion, influence, it's all kind of the same thing. It's the same set of skills.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. So, you know, I've told the story before. I took psychology and social psychology in junior college just to try to protect myself from this kind of thing. So I could, you know, try to be reasonable and make my decisions based on information and not in an emotional way or some looking glass self way or some, you know, victim of advertising or political spin kind of way. I want the truth, damn it. And yet I recognize that everybody else in class were going into advertising or government for a living, and that's why they were there, was to learn how to manipulate people. I don't know if any of them were ever attained the rank of master wizard, but, you know, basically, I guess you're right. At the end of the day, what's reason got to do with it? It's all about how you make people feel. And if you feed them jelly beans while you tell them your argument, they'll be 75% more likely to agree with you at the end, kind of thing. It's just,
yeah,
it is like that.
And with Donald Trump, it goes way beyond just saying things that people want to hear him say. Although that actually is a method of persuasion. If you say something that someone is thinking before they've said it, then that's a hugely persuasive thing to do. They'll end up agreeing with everything else you say after that. So when Trump did that about blocking Muslim immigration temporarily, he accurately guessed that a large percentage of the general population was thinking that but wouldn't say it out loud. And polls have backed him up. So that was not just a good guess and not just a politically expedient thing, which is the way it's being reported, but it's a deep persuasive technique. I'll give you another one. When Trump talks about whether Hillary Clinton was the worst Secretary of State of all time or not, That's a trick called selling past the close. All right. If he makes you think about the question of who else is as bad as she was, you've already accepted the premise that she was bad. And all you're talking about is whether she was the worst. So when you see somebody set up a question in that form, it's a car salesman trick. Mm-hmm. So when the car salesman says, do you think you would like the blue one in your driveway better or the red one? He's making you think past the decision of buying it.
But that's a pretty cheap trick, isn't it? That doesn't sound like a wizard technique as much as kind of a hack technique there, no?
Well, first of all, if you saw only one of the techniques in isolation, of course, it wouldn't mean much.
Oh, I see.
But you have to understand that you're getting a blizzard of associations and influence every time Trump opens his mouth. But the other thing that's interesting about influence is that you can tell somebody what you're doing while you're doing it to them, and it won't affect the fact that it works. So the fact that I told you just how that works, selling past the close, that doesn't change its effectiveness. It still works.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the other big trick that Trump does is he directs energy to where he wants it. So my best example was during the first debate, when he got the gotcha question about his comments about women in general, and he quickly brought up Rosie O'Donnell because that just absorbed all the headlines and turned it into sort of a focus on a character that he knew would not be popular with his Republican base. So he basically just owned the conversation simply by moving it to someplace irresistible, mm-hmm. that would keep the energy there.
Yeah.
And you'll see the same trick over and over. For example, when Chris Cuomo was interviewing on CNN, this was a while ago, a few months ago, and said, the Pope had some bad things to say about capitalism. You know, the question was a setup to get Trump to disagree with the Pope. All right, that's what the question was designed to do. Yeah. But what Trump did was he didn't fall for it. He said instead, he said some version of the Pope should be worried that ISIS is coming to take over the Vatican. Right now, as soon as you get that in your head, you forget what the question was, right? Because as you imagine ISIS coming into the Vatican and taking over, which, by the way, always has at least one pinky in truth, because ISIS would love to do that. They would love to do that if they could. So nothing he says is 100% crazy, but it's just provocative enough that it takes all the energy to a place where he's strong, mm-hmm. which is his opinions about immigration, defense, economics, and away from anything that would be a weakness for him.
And now, but I saw you say, Scott, on CNN, that what this amounts to is the others have no chance whatsoever. And Jeb Bush can basically do nothing but cry because, as you put on CNN, they're bringing sticks to a flamethrower fight. And he is he's a giant stomping and crushing them. And I can see your point there, that there's really nothing that they can do about this at this point. He's light years ahead.
A couple of clarifications. First of all, I don't support Trump. I'm not endorsing him. I'm rather just analyzing his methods.
Sure.
And in my blog for entertainment, I predict that he's definitely going to win. And I use the what I call the master persuader filter to make those predictions. Now, that doesn't mean it's true. I'm just saying that if you predict things based on this filter, see how it does. So I use that filter to predict that Carly Fiorina would hit a top in the polls after she mentioned the dead, squirming, aborted baby image, because what she did was pair that image with her in people's minds. And that really is the master persuader, suicide. Right. So that's something that Trump would never do, right? And it killed her. I mean, that was the end of Fiorina after that association. If you look at the closing statements of the last debate, each of the other candidates said something terrible was happening, the world was coming to an end. Trump made maybe a quick statement about things are bad, I'm going to make this place great, 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 it's going to be terrific, look at all the things I can do, I'll find trillions of dollars of free money that's overseas and bring it back. So what he does is he says things that make you simply feel good. He's not, at least in that example, none of it is a lie. It's he just focused on things that make you feel good. Now, you don't have a choice about feeling good when people say things that are images you like. That's just an automatic association. But if, let's say, You know, Rand Paul has a good intellectual idea of how we should approach taxes or anything else. That's an intellectual reason, all right? Mm-hmm. Your brain can look at that. It can reject it. It can accept it. Usually it rejects it because we don't like to change our minds. But Trump doesn't work on that level. He's not working on the rational level.
Right.
He's going for automatic connections.
And he's winning. It's terrific. No, I'm just kidding. All right, hold it right there, everybody. We'll be right back after this break with Scott Adams, the author of the Dilbert cartoon and the master wizard hypothesis about Donald Trump and his control of the masses' minds. It's a lot of fun. Go read his blog. It's a lot of great stuff on there. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Well, that was kind of a fitting intro for this interview with Scott Adams, author of the Dilbert cartoon. Hell, is that even the right way to say that? Author of a cartoon?
Sure. Okay. I say creator, but author works too.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Boy, I've been reading your stuff for years and years and years.
I'd like to think I'm not that old, but okay.
Yeah, sorry about that. Me too, if it makes you feel any better. All right. Hey, listen, so everybody, Scott has this theory about the master persuader, and he says that Donald Trump is one, and boy, oh boy, does he know all the tricks for getting people to give him his way, and he uses them unapologetically, and boy, is it working in the head-to-head polls with Hillary, and of course, he's just way ahead of everybody else. He's by far the front runner of this campaign, and he doesn't seem, you know, in the last couple election cycles, the Republicans all had their little Herman Cain, Rick Perry moment, but it never lasted. But this is nothing like that. This is just, man, is he way out ahead and staying there. But so here's the thing, though. To a lot of us, this guy is a freaking maniac. He doesn't seem to have any principles whatsoever. He believes only in himself. Some of his solutions are things like, I will find the most ruthless murderer in the entire Pentagon to kill every last Sunni until their Islamic State is gone. Or, you know, some madness. You know, the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. Yeah, well, a lot of the privileges that we've had are going to have to go. And things like this. And we think, you know, maybe he can master persuade some people, but some of the rest of us are thinking, you know, boy, I sure don't support any other candidates, I'll say, but can I say I support him the least when he's talking outright about violating people's right to pick what church they go to and this kind of thing? This is madness.
Well,
How can he get away with it? That's the real question, I guess.
Wait, where did he say anything about limiting the rights of legal Americans? I don't think you said anything along those lines.
Yeah, no, he did. Yeah. Well, I don't know exactly the frame of the question, but it was a legit newspaper reporter, Yahoo News or AP or Reuters or one of them, where they were asking him about closing down mosques. And then he referred to the Bill of Rights as a privilege and said, well, you know, we're going to have to get used to the idea and we're going to have to get rid of some of these privileges that we have had up until now.
Was he talking about specific mosques? I don't think he was talking about banning mosques in general.
No, I don't mean to imply in general, but it didn't seem like he was going to be discriminating that carefully. You know what I mean? It was a pretty threatening statement the way I heard it.
But let me check it. So this is fun for me because I've actually never talked to anybody with the opinion that you just expressed, and I've been waiting because I just want to ask you a few questions, if you
sure.
don't mind.
Yeah, no, of course.
What makes you think you know what's in his mind, given that he says loudly and often that he negotiates and asks for outrageous things so he can negotiate back, given that he states that and lives it and demonstrates it in 100% of all he has done for decades, why do you think it's different this time?
Well, I don't necessarily, but I have a problem. To me, it's criminal enough, almost, that he would normalize that kind of thing. When it used to be, even under George W. Bush, that, hey, man, don't be intolerant toward Muslims just for being Muslims. And Trump is saying, screw that. You know, anybody who, you know, has a minority share of the power, feel free to pick on them one way or the other. That's the side I'm on, he seems to be proclaiming. And like the Politico thing said, all the white supremacist groups are getting a big bump because, as the Stormfronter put it, their biggest problem was demoralization. And now they're going, yeah, the great white hope, everybody come on. And all the Klan groups all across the country are growing because of this guy saying, basically talking in ways that no other Republican would legitimize that level of bigotry, you know? And so, and like rounding up all the Mexicans and getting rid of them, that kind of deal, you know, or all the illegals, 12 million people.
But keep in mind, the things you're angry at are the things you believe he thinks, not the things he's proposed.
No, I'm talking about the things that he's talked about. We'll round up all the illegal immigrants and get rid of them. I'm not saying I think he will actually do that, but I'm saying he's creating an atmosphere where the right is worse than they always are. And he's helping give a stamp of approval on that from on high.
That's true. But let me just drill down on any one of those claims. Because what happens is, if you drill down on any one of them, individually you end up saying, okay, well, he's just trying to do the job of the president, which is get rid of the illegals and keep the legal people in and protect them. So really, that's just his job description is what he described. I mean, there's no one who thinks the country should have 11 million illegals. There are just different ways that you deal with it. Either you're trying to work with them. And by the way, I would agree with working with people and trying to figure out a way to keep the people who have been good citizens, if not legal Americans.
I certainly don't care if there are 12 million illegals in the country. What's illegal? The government said they can't come in. I don't care about that. And a lot of people don't. Well, a lot of people would be happy to welcome them all.
But let me ask you that. What's interesting is that Trump provides a plan, which you can hate, but it's not being compared to another plan. Mm-hmm. So if you have an opinion on his plan without an alternative, which I haven't heard yet, then you haven't quite created an informed opinion. So what would be the alternative?
Oh, you're asking me for one? Repeal every immigration law. That's my solution. That's easy.
And just open the borders?
Yeah, of course. Is this a free society or not?
I accept that as a consistent opinion.
Yeah, I'm a libertarian. I'm very consistent. Yeah.
But now, libertarian means just get rid of the governments in general, right?
Of course, yes, absolutely. Wars first. War and torture and mass rounding up and deportations are the first things to go. Mass imprisonment and mass murder.
Yeah. So, but if you follow that, don't you become Islamic eventually?
Huh?
Wouldn't the Islamic forces take over wherever there wasn't a government to stop?
Oh, come on, man. Are you really saying that? 1/7 of the population of the world is all hell-bent on one Islamic empire to rule them all? Is that what you think?
That's what they say. I'm just reporting what they say.
Well, whatever. But if a 5-year-old in kindergarten said the same thing, are you going to go, oh, okay, I guess you represent all the 5-year-olds and you're all coming to get me? And that's completely stupid. What are you talking about?
It is a group of people who have taken over most of several countries already and are planning attacks on other shores.
Well, no, they've taken over where America, by invading, has created ungoverned spaces. They have filled the vacuum in the smallest part of Iraq, and, okay, the majority, at least half of Syria, but that's because America made it that way for them, and that's not because their religion mandated all of this stuff.
Of course.
Aggression.
I'm agreeing. They're going into a vacuum.
Right. I'm saying you might as well be frightening me with Khrushchev from the 50s is going to come forward from the past to come and get me, or some other ridiculous boogeyman. No. The American people there's no enemy state on this planet. The closest thing we have to an enemy are these jihadist groups, and our government supports them right now in Syria, where they accidentally supported them before in Iraq, and in Libya was pretty deliberate. And anyway, no, all our government needs to do is stop intervening to protect us from terrorists. They're not protecting us from terrorists. They created these guys in the first place. Scott,
you
come
don't on. Want me to talk to you because you're afraid of what I'm going to say next.
No, I'm not. I'm just answering your question. Yeah. Please go ahead. The floor is yours.
Well, you just said that ISIS filled the vacuum that we created, and you said, why don't we create a vacuum over here by getting rid of the government? And I'm saying that vacuums get filled. That's all. I'm just agreeing with you.
Yeah, but you said it's
bad people fill vacuums.
Yeah, but I'm saying you're really saying that the likelihood would be the vacuum would be filled in America, not in Iraqi Sunnistan, but in America, it would be filled by the Islamic State and the U.S. government is the one holding them at bay? I mean, come on.
It would be filled by bad actors.
Tell me more about Donald Trump's magic tricks.
Okay. What would you like to hear?
Well, how is it that he gets these right populists to not mind all the completely ridiculous, inconsistent, and horrible things that he says and only see him as their champion? He even says the problem is wages are too high in America, and that's why the companies are leaving. At the same time, he says he's going to make all their wages go higher, and they just don't care. Is it because he has a coin and waves in front of their eyes, or what is it?
Well, I think the game of getting elected is saying lots of bullshit that people will believe, and I think all the candidates do that. I mean, there's nobody on the trail who's saying things that can actually happen. You know, it's all a lot of magic tricks of cutting expenses and cutting taxes at the same time, and a lot of magic. So his particular brand of baloney tastes different than other people's, but it's not less ridiculous.
See, now, here's a point where you and me are completely eye to eye, is when Jeb and the rest of them cry that, oh, Donald Trump is illegitimate, Karl Rove, this guy is so far out of bounds, whatever. He's actually, on some of these issues, he's just one click to the right or maybe to the left of them on this thing or another. And if he's completely illegitimate, they sort of have four fingers pointing back at themselves, it sure seems like, in a big way.
Right. He says some interesting traps. Take for example, his call for banning Muslim immigration. What you don't see until it develops is what a trap that is. Because as soon as I asked you for an alternate plan, obviously that's not your job to come up with alternate plans, and you had one, I guess. But if he does that to a standard politician, they have two choices. They either say, I don't have a plan, and then they can't get elected, or it's worse. They say, I do have a plan. We're going to let people in. We'll do it in some rigorous way. And then the odds of something blowing up after that is so high that nobody is going to put their name on that plan.
Right.
Hillary Clinton doesn't want to say, I support Plan A, and then Plan A is what causes a building to get blown up in 3 years. Right. She's never going to put her name on that. So Trump has created a situation where there can only be one plan under discussion, and it's his. Now, you can hate that plan or you can love that plan,
yeah.
But there's only one plan.
All right, now, Scott, I'm sorry. I just want to apologize to you. I'm actually keeping you over time a little bit, but I'd like to ask you one more thing, if that's okay.
Sure.
About Iraq War II. And this is a miracle to me. This is something that Ron Paul tried so hard, and he made great progress, but was never really able to succeed, you know, in any serious way. But Donald Trump, I think, has done so much to normalize regret over Iraq War II on the right. And he outright just says about Hillary Clinton, for example, you know, oh, I'm anti-Muslim. She killed a million of them or 100,000 of them or something, he said. And because of her stupidity and her mistakes and her ignorance and this kind of thing. Well, that's the exact same base that supports him. We're the hardest core supporters of Iraq War II who hated anyone who told them otherwise. And here Donald Trump says, oh, no, you're an idiot for supporting the war. Or at least she and Dick Cheney were idiots for supporting that war. And it doesn't seem to hurt him at all with the right. And I wonder, how is he pulling that off where they're able to get over that cognitive dissonance of having to take back their previous position that, you know, me and everybody at antiwar.com were all a bunch of traitors who should have been run out of town on a rail for knowing better back when?
Well, that's part of his magic. Certainly he can make anybody believe in anything. But there's more to that trick. Again, when he said Hillary Clinton killed hundreds of thousands of people, the media, when scrambling to figure out if the number was really that big or if she only killed 50 or 100,000. Right? So once you have it in your mind that it's some big number, oh, sure, he always exaggerates, but God, Trump didn't kill anybody. All he did is hire a lot of female executives for his company over the last decades when nobody was doing that. Hillary Clinton actually killed women, hundreds of thousands of women, innocent women. She killed them with her policies, he would say. Yeah. Again, I'm not taking sides. I'm just giving you the Trump persuasion method. Mm.
Yeah, and that really is the thing, is he's willing to say things that no one else would ever, you know, would dare, you know, like, for example, the right wing meme that George W. Bush kept us safe, and never mind the anthrax attack, and never mind, you know, this, that, or the other thing, and certainly never mind 9/11. That stuck for years. And Donald Trump is just like, yeah, really? And got rid of it with the wave of his hand, pulled the rug right out from under Jeb and hit his head and everything on that one. And that was a really powerful argument for a long time. I don't know how, but they had gotten away with it until Trump said, well, hey, who was in charge on the big day, man? You know? So.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that actually is helping, because I consider him actually to be quite a few clicks more dangerous than the average Republican, who I think are all pretty dangerous, as far as that goes. But I think he is so funny, and I just love him for destroying Jeb Bush, and the way that it's happened, reducing Jeb to a crying little baby and everything, is so beautiful. And, but I think he really disarms people with that humor, that, because he knows just what to say to make you laugh while he cuts somebody. You know, and but it sort of makes him seem less dangerous than I think he really is. I don't know if Mussolini ever, you know, really had a great sense of timing for a punchline. You know what I mean?
You know, the whole fascist Mussolini thing, I get the analogy, and you know, I get that he's got the mouth that looks like Mussolini. But when you start analyzing who he's after, they tend to be people who are not Americans to protect Americans. So his frame is completely different than those guys, but I do get that there's enough similarity that people are making sort of an automatic connection, very similar to the master persuader theory. Mm-hmm. If you were to actually dig into the details of, you know, is he a fascist or is he Hitler, it falls apart pretty quickly. But it feels like it. It totally feels like it. I mean, I get that too, but rationally it's not even close.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are some parallels. It's never the complete hyperbole, but when you're talking about picking on people because of who they are, then that is something that typically, you know, at least recently in America, we've tried to live down that path and do better. And he's bringing that back in a way that is further to the right than what was even the populist right in, the 1990s, I think. So
far, he's only been after criminals. He's not said anything about a group that we're not actually trying to kill us. And he's not anti-Muslim. He's just saying, hey, if nobody has a better idea how to keep us safe, let's do this temporarily until we figure it out. That's not crazy. You know, you could hate it, but it's not insane.
All right, fair enough. Hey, listen, I kept you way over time here. I really appreciate your time on the show, Scott.
All right, thanks for having me.
It's very interesting stuff there. All right, y'all, that is Scott Adams. He is the creator and the author of the Dilbert cartoon. It's blog.dilbert.com for the cartoons and the political writing and all the rest of it. And, yeah, well, see y'all tomorrow.